The talk I wanted to give this evening was similar to a talk which I gave in London a few weeks ago. And the reason many of you may know that I went to London a few weeks ago was an invitation to give a masterclass at a conference on human resources, basically to big business people, where there were managers from companies like PricewaterhouseCoopers and Intel and British Airways, and also from the National Health Service of Britain, who gave me an invitation to go back to teach another masterclass at their annual conference later on in this year. A invitation which I refused because I have to come some Friday nights to teach here. But obviously what a Buddhist monk said there was very well received, and many of you may have seen in the last Saturday's Western Australian an article about that visit. I think I gave the editor the headline for that little article about a brown robe in a sea of suits, because it was a monk teaching all these big business people how to run their companies. Which is obviously a strange thing, because what does a Buddhist monk who is penniless, who has just lived in a monastery and has never been in that type of business, what does he know about teaching in human resources? But obviously that's what we say has a huge effect and is well regarded, because the organization where I went to, the Chartered Institute of Personal Development, is the biggest human resources company in Europe. Their job basically is to train managers in how to get a greater morale, more efficiency, more harmony in the workplace. And so I was mentioning this afternoon to a group of Vietnamese who had come from Melbourne. When I mentioned that, one of the young men was quite surprised. Surely Buddhism and business don't match. And because that's what they say, and because I disagreed with them, that's what this talk is going to be this evening. Buddhism in the business world. Because I disagree there that Buddhism has a huge amount to offer in the workplace. Especially because many of you will spend a huge proportion of your time in the office at work. Maybe 30, 40, I don't know, 50% of the time sometimes these days. And what happens to you in the work environment affects not only your happiness and job satisfaction, it also affects your health, it affects your family life, it affects your basic well-being in every aspect, because 30-40% of your life is a huge chunk. And unfortunately, too many people have so much stress and negativity at their work. They can't come home, they're either just so tired they cannot relate warmly with their family. Or else they just get angry and tired and they just hide and they just do nothing. They don't really have a good family life because their office life is not so good. And when your family life is not so good, you have too many people separating. Kids suffer, the kids don't have time with their parents, and the kids suffer. And then all those problems you take to work the following day, and the whole feedback mechanism of negativity continues, and people are having a terrible time. And that also will affect the success of the company too. So just focusing on what happens in the office is directly responsible for a huge amount of your happiness and suffering in life. And that's Buddhism's concern. The lessening of suffering, the creating of more happiness and well-being, and more understanding. And with that understanding, even the time you have at work can be more productive, more fulfilling, more peaceful, so that that will help you in your family life. So what sort of things can Buddhism offer, you know, for the workplace? And the general principles of things like mindfulness and compassion help enormously. But not just those general principles of mindfulness and compassion. In all the many centuries that Buddhism has existed, we have worked out some wonderful strategies to actually apply those principles of mindfulness and compassion. And that power of a mind which is focusing on those two very effective mind states of awareness and kindness, those strategies which have been developed over the centuries, when a Buddhist puts them into practice and develops more than usual kindness, more than usual awareness, that does affect your life in the office enormously. And one disciple in Penang, when I taught a retreat there last December, when she came up for an interview, she was beaming, she was smiling, and I asked her, why, was it your meditation? I said, no, she said, it was her promotion. She got this very hard fought for promotion in her business because that her performance at work was so more in advance of all of her so-called competitors. The bosses very easily gave this quite young lady this huge promotion. And she was in customer service in a huge corporation in Penang. And the reason why she told me about this is because she said it was the Buddhist training which she had got her this promotion. And the particular part of Buddhism was this mindfulness and compassion business. And the particular story which gave her this promotion was one which is one of the central stories in that book of mine, Open the Door of Your Heart, and which I've taught many, many places because it's very simple but also very powerful. And for those of you who've heard it before, I don't mind repeating it because it's one of the great stories in that book. It comes from Tolstoy. It's the story of the Emperor's Three Questions. But because many of you are familiar with that, I will only deal with it in brief. The Emperor's Three Questions goes like this. An emperor was fed up with ordinary religion, wanted to find his own spirituality, and he decided that all religion boiled down to the answer to three basic questions, which was, when is the most important time, who is the most important person, and what is the most important thing to do? So when is the most important time? You all know the answer to that. It is now. Yes, now's the most important time. And I often say this when I give talks. When's the best time to say how much you love the partner you're living with? Now. If you leave it till tomorrow, your relationship dies. When's the best time to say sorry? Now. I think Mr. Ben Cousins needs to listen to this talk. And Mr. Howard. And Mr. Blair, and Mr. Bush especially. Because if you leave off saying sorry for too long, it gets harder and harder to say, and the time is missed. For those of you who've known death of a loved one, it's always one of the terrible things of a death, that the person's no longer there, and you can't say what you always meant to say, because you left those moments called now pass by. As you all know, that my father died when I was 16. I remember at his funeral service, these events, even though it's, 40 years ago, they're still very vivid in your memory because they're the most important moments of your life, losing a loved one. And at that time, I always felt guilty. Guilty for the things I did which I shouldn't have done and which I should have said sorry for. And the things which you never said. You know, how much you loved and cared for your father, how much you respected him. But what his death taught me, that those moments we call now, they pass so quickly. And once they pass, they never come back again. And you've lost those opportunities. And it is painful to have lost the opportunities to say to someone who you really cared for, who you respected, that you did love and care for them, you did respect them, to say it to their face. Because I didn't understand the importance of now. I let it pass, and it could never be said, because my father died. Now is such an important time. Please, as they say in common culture, not grab the day, but grab the moment. The day is too long. The moment is the only time you have. And people who know the importance of now, this is the most important time, become very successful people. The next question was not the when, but the who. Who is the most important person? Whenever I say this in public, whenever I've got time to people who haven't heard this before, I always ask for suggestions. Who is the most important person? And I said this at a Cancer Wellness Association group, which came to our monastery on Wednesday. And still, many of those people who were either cancer sufferers or relations and friends of people who had either suffered or died from cancer, most of them put up their hands and said, oneself, me, is the most important person. And of course, that's the wrong answer. Because the right answer, and this is the reason why these insights are so powerful, because they go deeper than you expect. They're not obvious. That's why they're called insights. The most important person is the one you're with, whoever they happen to be. It's another meaning of the word now. So whenever you are with your partner, please make sure that they feel that they are the most important person in the world. Do you understand what I mean? I think you all do, because sometimes you're with your husband or your wife, your partner. You're talking to them, and they're just trying to get rid of you. They're not taking you seriously. You know how that feels. That's where your relationship starts to die. You're not important to them anymore. You feel that. They're not listening. The whole relationship starts to fade and shatter. There's nothing there anymore. But if you can always remember that person who you're committed to, the one you live with, when they're in front of you, please remember that they are the most important person in the world. They'll feel it, and your relationship will change. If that's your kid, it doesn't matter if you're tired. They're in front of you, they're the most important person in the world for you. Then you have a relationship with your children. And much of the problems of family life will be solved just by giving your kid that sense of importance. Sincerely, honestly, really. When they're in front of you, they're the most important person in the world. And lastly, the most important thing to do is to care. To care, again, is halfway between being caring, compassionate, kind, and being careful. Being aware, mindfulness, alert. That's the most important thing to do. The combination of alertness, mindfulness, with kindness, compassion. Those were the answers to the Emperor's three questions. Now is the most important time. The one you're with is the most important person. And the most important thing to do is to care. Very simple, but incredibly powerful. I can't resist saying one of the stories which is very inspiring, and how that particular, the Emperor's Three Questions, has done a huge amount of benefit here in Perth. Because it must have been about 10 or 12 years ago now, when I was invited to, I think, Morley Recreation Centre, because the education department in Perth had hired that place for a conference, a one-day seminar. And when I got the invitation was inviting me to give the keynote address, an education seminar. And again, I hadn't got a clue why I was invited. But when I saw on the invitation there was a free breakfast, I decided to accept. Because sometimes you don't get breakfast in a monastery, sometimes you do. But this was like a big breakfast, so yeah, I'm in for that. So you rock up at Morley, and what happened to me happens to many people. This person comes up to me, they got their badge on, you know, the organizer, and they come up and they say, "Hello, Ajahn Brahm, do you remember me?" That happens many, many times to me, and unfortunately, I'm a monk, I have to be honest, and so I said no. Fortunately, she was not upset. It's a terrible question to ask people, so please don't do that. You don't want to offend you, you know, but we've got to be honest. fortunately that she laughed, and then she reminded me who she was. And this led to this amazing story. I love telling this story, because quite often I might get teary-eyed at this story. It's one of those beautiful events of my life. Because she told me that she was the principal of, I'm not sure if it was Kelmscott Primary or Kelmscott High School, just south of the river between Gosnells and Armidale. And I had given a talk at her school, just on Buddhism. I happened to mention that story, the Emperor's Three Questions. That night, she sent in her resignation. Now is the most important time. But not because she hated her job. It's because she told me that there's something she always wanted to do in her life. And that story inspired her to do it now. She resigned from being principal of this school. And the one thing she wanted to do, the one thing which worried her, was there were many young people at that time who were not going to school, who were living in the parks of Perth. They were homeless. They'd run away from home. They were into petty crime, taking drugs. Girls who were selling their bodies, 12, 13 years of age, for sex. Child prostitutes. Losers, no hopers. The ones which were too difficult for anyone else to look after, except maybe the police. And the police couldn't do that much, lock them up for a few days. They were out again. She wanted to help do something. Now she had a philosophy for her work. The Emperor's Three Questions were her philosophy. Now the most important time. She went to those parks, those dark places in the city at night, and found those kids. But the point was that when she was in front of them, she remembered, it doesn't matter if they're a child prostitute or if they're a petty thief or a burglar or a drug addict or whatever, that person in this moment is the most important person in the world for me. And she said it was amazing just how powerful that attitude was. She said many of those kids for the first time, and some of these kids told me this, they said for the first time in their life, because there's a few of the kids actually were at this seminar, they said it was the first time they could remember that a person in authority, an adult, was respecting them, was really listening to them, was saying that that person is, this moment, really important for me. And that attitude changed how these kids responded. They started telling her about where they were from, their histories, why they were, where they were doing. And that, instead of being judged or being her feeling afraid, they opened up, told her their stories, and they could discuss if it was at all possible to get them in an education system again. And from that research, she tailored a program, a very innovative program, to try and get these kids back into school so they could complete their education. And of course, she had to do those Emperor's Three Questions to the bureaucrats, in East Perth to get funding for this. But again, because now's the most important time, that bureaucrat in the suit or the business dress in front of me is the most important person. I really care. Because of that importance she gave even those bureaucrats, she got the funding. The program started. And this whole seminar, it was 7 years after I'd been to her school, was to celebrate the success of this program. In the end, I never gave the keynote address. I gave a speech, but it wasn't a keynote. The keynote was given by one of the kids. One of the boys was about 17, who told where he'd come from. Of gross parental abuse ever since he was young, having no choice, it seemed, but going onto the streets. And then this woman came along from out of nowhere and cared for him, who gave him respect because you are the most important person. So he joined this school, which was tailored to his needs. What made me cry was when he said, "I'm going to university next year." A kid who was lost had, for this program, been led into a life, a positive life of hope and success. There was another girl who was the street prostitute. She came up. She wasn't going to university yet, but she was in a full school program. Lives had been changed. And that program was what changed it. That's why I was invited there. But that very philosophy was what this girl from Penang was using. In customer service, it doesn't matter how busy she was. As I mentioned at this business talk, what is business anyway? Business is not doing many, many things. The definition of busy is doing too many things at the same time. I like that definition because that's accurate. Sometimes I do that, too many things at the same time. But you can get much more done if you try and just do one thing at a time. It's amazing. High achievers seem people to get a lot done. Some of them, you look at them, they seem to be just floating along. Hardly doing anything, you think. They don't look busy. But my goodness, at the end of the day, they get a huge workload completed. Busyness is doing too many things at the same time. So this lady, the one you're with, is the most important person. Now is the most important time. And she just cared. She cared for her customers, and obviously she cared for her bosses as well. That's why she was recognized, and she said that is what got her the promotion. So these aren't sort of things which are just airy-fairy, which you just, you know, use when you're on your weekends in the temple. These are actually strategies which work even in the business environment. The most important thing to do is to care. And sometimes people think, yeah, but business is tough, business is hard. But from people I've met, they say no. The only way to get real success in business, and if you really think about it, it does make sense, is to have enough care for the people who are working for you, for your suppliers, for your customers, for everyone who's involved in the business. Because when there is that sense of care and trust, only then will you get people working that much harder. They'll be motivated, they want to. One of the stories which I told from real life, this is not from the Buddhist suttas, that's a long time ago, but this is from real life because I collect these stories. There was an engineering firm in the Midlands of England called Farrelly and Sons who won a prestigious award for best business practice a couple of years ago. They were in building maintenance, you know, who were contracted to look after, you know, whether it's the toilets or the maintenance, the lifts, that sort of stuff in these big high-rise office blocks. The reason why they got the prize was because in 12 months they had trebled their turnover and doubled their profits and no staff left. And the way they achieved that was a very simple strategy. They banned overtime. No one in the company was allowed to work beyond the 8 or 9 hours which was stipulated for them. Now, of course, that is counterintuitive for many companies. You think, well, we've got lots of projects to do, let's work harder. And what happens? Yeah, you get those projects done, but the quality is no good. The staff are just resentful, and they will leave. They'll have backbiting because of their tiredness, and tiredness leads to negativity and grumpiness. Instead, they banned overtime, which meant that that staff worked really efficiently. Number one, they didn't want to leave a company who obviously showed that they cared for their staff. I don't know where you work, but does your company care for you? If you found one which did, would you want to leave such a company? Would you want to make sure that company was successful? You'd be motivated. Morale would go up. The quality of your work would improve. You want to work harder. Simply because people cared for you. A basic law of karma. If you care for someone else, really, chances are they're going to care back for you. Law of cause and effect, karma. So number one, they didn't have so much staff loss. And anyone in the company knows that huge amounts of resources are lost when you have to retrain a staff. It takes weeks, months, maybe even longer than that. When you've lost a key employee, to get someone else and train them and to get them to have all those contacts, not just to know how the company works, but to have all those other contacts, you know, which is so important in life, especially in company life. Sometimes by losing your staff, you're actually losing the basic resource of your company. That was one of the messages, because when I was at this human resources conference, it wasn't just giving my own talk, because you know, I want to sort of increase my understanding of life, and so I was sitting in the back of many of the other sessions and listening to what these top gurus of management were saying. And I was just so impressed that they were saying Buddhism, basically. They said that one of the terrible things about these huge companies, whether it's Intel or whether it's PricewaterhouseCoopers, they train somebody, and then when they get really good at their job, they go somewhere else. You say, what a loss that is. You know, financially, morale-wise. One of the most important things for a successful company is to retain, you know, those staff, the key players. What they call in modern human resource management is to maintain the talent. And you just have to look at many sort of economic journals to know that that is one of the biggest problems in modern businesses. To spot the talent, to train that talent, and most importantly, to keep it. Because other people will try and poaching the key members of the organization. Because they are what make the company successful. If you want to keep that talent, you've got to be kind to them. Number one. And so that kindness sort of kept those people in that company. And that kindness spread because they were only working the 8-9 hours a day, and they could not take work home, they could actually have a good family life. When they went home, they could relax with their wife and kids, or their husband and their kids, or their partner and their children, or whatever. And because they could do that, they didn't have those family problems which too many people take to work at 9 o'clock, 8 o'clock, in whatever time you go to work in the morning. How can you work efficiently when you're worrying about the argument you had with your partner last night? Or you're worrying about your kids' performance at school, or whether they're taking drugs or whatever. Obviously, that's going to impinge upon your work performance. So by allowing people to have that time with their family, when these people were at work, they worked efficiently. Didn't have these other things bothering them. And because they weren't so tired and stressed, they didn't have all this office politics, which people keep asking me about. So how many times people come and sort of ask me, just office politics, they're having such a hard time because they don't get on with this person in the office or that person's being really rude to them. It's a big problem. And a lot of those problems comes because of just basic tiredness, stressed out, burnt out, just too much demanded of you. You just had enough. So how can you develop that sort of companionship with other people you have to work for? And everybody knows, whether it's a Manchester United soccer team, or whether it's the coach of the Eagles or the Dockers, that team spirit, being able to work together, is one of the huge important factors of any success. So that company has staff morale, they had efficiency, and that spread to not just their families, to their suppliers and their customers. People wanted these people to do their office maintenance or their building maintenance. Just like these guys. Because the guys liked the company. Because the company was caring for them. I can see so many other reasons why this company trebled their turnover they got twice as many new contracts. And also that they doubled their profits, which is why they won their business prize. So you can see with such, you know, spiritual values in the workplace, it does make the whole work experience positive for everyone in there, even for the CEOs who've got to worry about the bottom line and the profits. Basically, everybody can win. You can have Buddhism in business and both win, which was the message of that Fowley and Sons. But it's not only that. Once you have sort of that sort of compassion and that kindness there, that people actually do have the ability to make contacts with each other. I'm not sure how many of you read that book many years ago, Daniel Goleman's Emotional Intelligence, where he was making the position, making the thesis, and proving it very convincingly that success in life is nothing, well, it is something to do, but not really much to do with your intelligence, your IQ. Now, your IQ is something which will get you your degrees at university, but in real life, the people who are successful are those who, say, have emotional intelligence, which means the ability to talk with another person, to contact them, to make that friendships. Because in business, it's all about connections. How you can work together, how you can get those new contracts, how you can get your suppliers to do the right thing by you, is about trust and kindness. Who do you want to do business with? This is a story from Sydney. I guess I introduce a couple of stories from Sydney. Because, you know, I go to Sydney quite regularly. There's a group over there which I look after. And one of these people was telling me that they were in this big business. I think it was food business. And anyway, that they were trying to arrange a big multi-million dollar contract with some Taiwanese business people. And these Taiwanese business people, they were emailing backwards and forwards, and eventually they had the contract ready. So the Taiwanese businessman flew to Sydney to sign the contract. It was, you know, the last piece of in a jigsaw puzzle for this multi-million dollar contract. Now, obviously, this was worth a lot to this guy's business. But when they came to Sydney, they said, yeah, we agree to sign the contract. We'll sign it tonight in the bar. You will pay for the drinks. And after we finished at the bar, you'll take us to a brothel and supply us with girls for the night. At which he said, sorry, I'm a Buddhist, I keep five precepts, I don't drink alcohol. You can go to a restaurant if you like, but not to a bar. And number two, I've got a wife, I love her, I'm committed to her. I don't break that third precept of adultery. I won't do this. And apparently, this is a true story, the Taiwanese business people were so upset that basically they said, look, if you don't do this, no deal. And I was very proud of this disciple. He said, no deal. I'd rather keep my precepts and keep my integrity and love my wife than have this big profitable deal for my company. So they broke off. The deal was off. And he went back to his home. Obviously disappointed, but he felt good about himself. He'd done the right thing. Late that night, he got a telephone call. The Taiwanese businessmen had been drinking in the bar, and they were thinking, they're discussing. They said, look, this guy is trustworthy. He won't even cheat on his wife. He's not very likely to cheat on us. Can we come round to your house and sign the contract? And so the contract was signed. And what a wonderful thing that was, because those Taiwanese businessmen, it made sense. Would you want to sign a business contract with someone who cheats on his wife and gets drunk? Doesn't make sense to me. Maybe I'm not in business, but if you can't trust the people you are in partnership with, what's going to happen to your business? It's a very, very risky undertaking. So you sign a contract. This other story, this other disciple, who was a very nice lady. She was in the, the fashion business. And she'd been very successful in Sydney. But on one occasion, she had to go to London, again, to sign the contract. Big, you know, contract, you know, for her fashion business. I think she supplies Myers and Coles and stuff like that with her designs and stuff. So, she flew all the way from Sydney to London. I've just been to London, just even from Perth. You get jet-lagged, you get tired. For me, I had like a day before I went to the conference, so I could actually have a rest and a relaxation. But for her, it was, as soon as you arrive in Heathrow, straight to the hotel, just check in, have a shower, and then back straight to the office to actually to meet the board and the managing director. And so she was very tired, very jet-lagged. And when she got into the office, into the boardroom, the directors told her immediately, you've wasted your time. You might as well go back to Sydney. The MD is in a filthy mood this morning. He's not in a good mood most days anyway, but this day is particularly bad. He's been shouting at us, there's no way in the world you're going to get your contract signed. No way. But she did get her contract signed. You know why? Because she'd been learning meditation and Buddhism, you know, from monks like me. You know what happened? She said, well, look, I'm here anyway. I might as well see the bloke. Well, he'd be down in about 15 minutes. So while she was waiting, she prepared for her encounter with this monster of an MD, a managing director, by going into a corner and sitting in meditation and doing metta, loving kindness. Just what, you know, you learn here. And she was disturbed. The managing director came in. Who are you? But much louder than that. What do you want? And instead of actually, you know, saying, you know, what she wanted, who she was and what she was there for, you know, she just got up and she had so much of this metta, loving kindness in her. And she told me she didn't know where this came from. It just came out spontaneously. She looked at this managing director who was glowering at her and said, you've got such beautiful blue eyes like my baby daughter, Holly. And he said, really? Really, is that so? And they had the contract signed in 5 minutes. And so it was amazing, because of that loving kindness, and it was genuine, she wasn't playing, it really came from inside, because she spent 15 minutes just meditating on metta. And it worked. Now, how many times we say that overcome this anger with loving kindness? But it does actually work. And it worked. And she got her contract signed. We said the funny thing happened afterwards, as soon as the managing director went out of the room, all the other directors, they would not let her go. They wanted her to teach them how to do this. It was so impressive. And that's how you do it. Now's the most important. You don't plan these things. Now's the most important time to care. And that managing director in front of you is the most important person in the world. You care for them. It's amazing just how effective that is. But you know, one of the things in business, not just getting the contracts, sometimes in business, especially if you're a manager, one of the things which I heard at this conference was, managers just do not know how to lead. That sometimes they get promoted into these positions because they're very, very good engineers, or they're very, very good salesmen or saleswomen, but they don't know how to lead a team. Because part of leading a team is actually what we call in business performance, a performance assessment. Where you've got to see the members in your team and actually tell them how they're doing. And sometimes you have to tell them that they're not doing well. And I think maybe some of you have that experience in an office of one or two people who are not pulling their weight. People who aren't really meant to be there, are too lazy or whatever it is, and other people in that office have to cover for them, they have to work harder for them. And just the manager doesn't see it, or the manager just is too scared to tell people they're not working well. And it's because of that that many leaders, many managers, they just don't want to tell the other person what's going on. They don't know how to do that without giving offense. Because it's a tough task, isn't it? You're a manager, you're going to tell someone, look, you're not performing well, you're not doing well. That's their career. They've got a family to feed, a mortgage to pay. Gee, it's a tough thing to tell another person to criticize them. And some managers are so scared they put it off and off and off and off and off. Until in the end, they go up to them and say, "You're fired." Say, "Why? You should know." But you've never been told. And a lot of times those problems can be overcome by nipping them in the bud, by having those personal skills, that emotional intelligence, to take a person aside and to be able to point out the faults in a way which they don't feel offended, they don't feel rejected, they don't feel not valued, but they actually take on board and they may be able to do something about it. And how is that done? Well, I told in this little conference, because I'm a manager of a monastery and spiritual dictator of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia. So, you know, sometimes you have to tell people. But how you do that, and it's a wonderful way of doing it, general rule, 5 pieces of praise for every piece of criticism. So if you're a manager, and you've got to give someone performance assessment, find 5 things which, you know, they're doing really well, which you really value, which you really respect about their work in that office, in that company, in that team. And tell them that first of all, because it makes you feel good. And then come with the criticism, you know, the mistakes they're making. When you couch it, not just you blurt it out straight away, what's wrong? If you blurt it out straight away, the people think that that's what you think of them, you're not valued, you're not respected, and you get defensive. You know, you don't listen, you just don't take it on board, you think the boss is being a bastard, and there's no communication left. But if that boss actually tells nice things about you, "Oh, this is really nice. Oh, yeah, that's good. Yeah, I'm really glad that you've seen that, because I have been working hard in those areas. I'm glad you value that." And then you tell about the weakness, their mistakes, and straight away you've got their empathy. Now, this is basic Buddhism, which I've known a long time, but apparently that some psychology person wrote a paper about this a year ago, and it was published in many papers. That's actually how you tell someone off or tell them you're doing something wrong, a mistake. You get their empathy first of all. You make sure that they realize, yes, you do care for them. You don't assume that they know you care. You've got to make it plain, explicit, by 5 pieces of praise. And then when you say the mistake, they can realize, oh yeah, but it's realize you're not rejecting the whole of them, you're just rejecting a part of their performance, not the whole performance. So they don't feel rejected, they don't feel undervalued, they don't feel they're not appreciated, they are appreciated, and the very fact that you appreciate them so much is why you're telling them this, so you can appreciate them even more, so they can be of more value. Because one of the things I learned at this conference was that many people in a office, in your work, you want to learn more, you want to grow, that your work in the workforce is a learning experience. It's not just about making money, it's understanding more of the world, more of the company, more of your speciality in this world, so you can grow your skills. People want to grow skills, and they want to be helped. But sometimes we don't know how to help each other. So that way, the manager goes up, "Yeah, I really value 5 things. Now this is a bit which you're weak on." And number 2, it's not your problem. It's not my problem. Remember, I keep saying this most weeks, it's our problem. In a marriage, it's not the wife's problem, it's not the husband's problem, it's our problem. Very often, I do marriage ceremonies. I tell the happy couple, "From now on, you should not think of yourself." And they say, yeah, we shouldn't think of ourselves anymore. And I tell the bride, "You shouldn't think of your husband." Tell the husband, "You should not think of your bride." And that's when they get confused. "If I'm not supposed to think of myself, I'm not supposed to think of them. If I can't think of either of those, who am I supposed to think about?" And the answer is, you think about us. Not him, not her, not me. It's an us. That changes the whole dynamics. It's the same when you're pointing out someone's faults if you're a manager. It's not your problem. It's not my problem. It's our problem. So that way you're not really criticizing and putting a person down too much. You're saying that, now I'm here for you, you're here for me, let's work it out together. So the manager also takes responsibility for moving forward from that defect in their performance, finding ways where they can't do the work because they're stressed at home, they need some sort of time off, or because they're sick, or because they're not in the right job, or they need some extra training, or whatever it is, you know, that you realize that that manager is actually caring for you. They're not so much criticizing, say, this is a problem, we value you, we want to value you more, this is a nurturing environment, this is a learning, we want your skills to grow, so let's find a way to make them grow together. And you can see just how positive that sort of attitude is. It means that everybody in that company, instead of having negativity, instead of having this terrible office politics and afraid of the boss or the boss being afraid of the workers, because they are sometimes afraid of telling them off, that we have a beautiful way of moving forward together. The personal skills, the emotional skills. And obviously, that this is straight from the words of the Buddha, when you're telling somebody off, make sure that you do it with kindness, right time and place. That's an important thing for a manager to know. It's an important thing for a wife, husband, a parent to know. You don't tell somebody off when they just had such a hard day at work. They've, you know, bashed their car, pranged their car in a small accident. They've had a disappointment at work or whatever it is. You don't tell a person off, you know, when they're tired, they're stressed, you know, when they are already had enough this day. You've got to look at a person's body language to see when they're relaxed, when they're reasonably happy. Choose that time and people will listen to you. So if you're a manager, you look at the workers, you find a time when they're reasonably relaxed, as best they can be in the day. Not the first thing on a Monday morning. That's the wrong time to go and sort of be hauled into the manager's office. You know, a nice time when they feel pretty reasonably relaxed, maybe just after lunchtime might be one of the best times. And then people are more willing to learn. Time and place is important. The way you do this, making sure it is out of kindness and compassion. You are really aware of what that other person, you know, looks like, so you know it's not the right time, you know it's the right time and place. You do it in a way which is together, kindness, learning, nurturing, moving forward. The other thing which I learned, it also has to be timely. You can't wait for too long. Don't put it off out of fear. It needs to be done. It's like going to the dentist. The sooner you get it done, so the less it's going to hurt. And also the less it's going to cost, probably. So feedback has to be given timely. Because I remember some of the HR people were in their talks were saying that sometimes by the time you get that feedback, it's months later, you don't know you are causing a problem. You think, why didn't you tell me earlier? I could have done something about it. I didn't realize that my performance wasn't so good. Because a lot of times the feedback you get of your work in the company, in the office, is far too late to do anything about it. And you get resentment. Obviously, these people don't care about you because they're not there to take you by the hand and get you to perform better. So that way that these skills, you know, which you learn here, they help enormously in the office. Businesses like that. They want to have a harmonious workforce. Because a harmonious workforce where you can point out mistakes in a positive way and actually overcome those mistakes to move forward a nurturing environment, getting the people behind the company behind the people as a team, good morale, even passion for what you're doing, gee, that company's going to take off. Has to. People want to work there. Wouldn't it be a wonderful thing? I don't know how many of you, when you get up on a Monday morning, that you want to go to work. You think, wow, Monday morning, I can go to work again today. Wouldn't that be a wonderful thing if you had that feeling? You think that can be achieved? Maybe it can. So anyway, that way that these strategies, they do actually help. And of course, the greatest strategy of all is the timeout strategy. Simply because that sometimes when you are working, sometimes you get so much to do and the pressure's on you so much that your efficiency goes down. Which is why that those of you who come here and learn a tiny bit of meditation, you don't need to be, you know, get into these deep jhanas and become enlightened and be able to levitate and do all these amazing, weird, crazy things. But just having a little bit of peace, being able to drop the past, drop the future, drop all the thinking, just focus on the breath for just a few minutes. That has enormous value in the office. Simply being able to relax and put things down for a while. As you must have seen this simile many, many times, because I say this so often. How heavy is a glass of water? The answer is, the longer you hold it, the heavier it feels. If I keep holding this for 5 minutes, I start to get in pain. If I keep holding this for 10 minutes, I'll be in agony. If I keep holding this for half an hour, I'm a stupid monk. What should I do when it starts to get heavy? You put it down. You don't throw it away. You put it down for maybe a minute or maybe two. I often say, if you don't believe me, you can try this at home. After 1 or 2 minutes, you pick it up again and it actually feels lighter. And that's stress in a nutshell. Stress is not how much water you have in your cup. It's not how many duties you have to perform in your office, in your work. Stress is all about, when it gets heavy, carry on holding it, carry on holding it. Keep pushing through the pain. You just get more pain, more stress. All you need to do when it gets a bit too much, put it down, for goodness sake. And if you put it down for a few moments, then when you pick it up again, it actually feels lighter. It feels easier to carry. Which means that you don't have the stress-related problems of being grumpy, angry at your fellow workers, angry at your wife, your husband, your kids, your parents when you go home, even angry at the monks. You don't call me up so much, you don't worry Sister Ajahn Wayama, so we can have a much easier time as well. You don't get so sick, but most important, your efficiency goes up. Because it's not just how many hours you put in at the workplace. It's how clear you are when you're doing that work. If you're not clear-minded, you make too many mistakes. The quality of your work goes down. You miss too much of what the customer needs. You just don't work well because you're not efficient anymore. It's so obvious to me, being a meditator. There are times when I'm tired. And I know that the talk is not going to be so hot, simply because your mind is not so clear. But when your mind is really clear, so some of those best talks I give, like on meditation retreats or during the rains retreat, because there's so much meditation, the mind is so still, it gets really powerful. You get really, really clear. It's obvious. You put down your glass and your efficiency, your clarity, the quality of your work improves enormously. You just spend 10 minutes during your lunch hour calming the mind. Or like one person does. It's a great little technique. Every hour, on the hour, he sits at his desk in front of his computer screen, closes his eyes and meditates for 1 minute, 60 seconds. Every hour, on the hour, he does nothing for 1 minute. His boss, fellow workers, go past his desk and think, oh, I must be thinking about something. They don't realize that he's, you know, not working. He's meditating. So by resting, by centering himself every hour on the hour for 1 minute, it means that the other 59 minutes are very good and very clear. 1 minute of meditation every hour is an investment of time. You make it up with greater efficiency afterwards, but then you don't have any stress as well. So these are strategies. which should be introduced in every office. That's basically, and a few other things, but basically why I was given this free air ticket to go to London Hotel, and why when I came back there was another invitation to the National Health Service Conference, the National Conference in Birmingham in October, but I can't go because it's rage retreat. These things work and they're valued. The HR professionals noticed this, and I got this wonderful question time afterwards. This lady in an expensive business suit put her hand up. Come on, you know, you say any questions. He said, this is not a question, this is a comment. So that's amazing. I'm going to put everything into practice in my company. What a wonderful accolade that was. So, at this conference, because my brother and his daughter, my niece, turned up, just before I was about to give my masterclass, they turned up and the message came through, you've got some family members here who want to come in for free. So I said, come on, I've come all this way. And you know, it's, you know, can you get them? So I talked the organizers into letting them in for free. Because it's good karma having a brother as a monk, having an uncle as a monk. I usually call it Uncle Munkle, is the usual word. And, but that's when I found out that how much they were charging. You know, for just my talk, you know how much they were charging? £300. How much is that in? That's about 700, no. How much is that in Aussie money? $750. You see, and you're getting all this for absolutely free. Wow, what a bargain. Coming to the Buddhist Society in Western Australia on a Friday night, so thank you very much for the bargain. And hopefully that what we said this evening will enhance what you do in the workplace. Because some of you are managers, maybe lower level managers, higher managers, I don't know who you are, but it helps. So Buddhism and business, they do mix. And it's wonderful actually to get those messages into the workplace for the happiness and well-being of so many thousands and millions of people, and also for the economy as well. So really, this talk should have been sponsored by Mr. Costello. So, that's the talk this evening. Are there any comments or questions about this evening's Dhamma talk? Any questions or comments? Okay. Oh, there's one from over there and then from Dania. Okay, I'm not quite sure what you're saying, but to repeat the question, it said a big, bad, nasty multinational company. They learnt how, I think, people worked, and that they became more efficient, and then it became even more big, more nasty multinational company. You know that one of the biggest and oldest multinational companies in the world is the Buddhist Sangha. We've been going for 2,500 years. It is for the happiness and well-being of every being. That's a profit, and everyone winner. For the, not the sort of the gross national product, but the subtle national product, which is more important, the happiness of everybody. And look, what this human resources conference was saying, that this is what everybody was saying. That model of business is unsustainable. If you don't care and look after your people, then the people will leave. They won't work well. They'll destroy the company like a cancer from within. And this is what all these other people were saying. These are the leading gurus of business in Europe, and also from places like Cornell University and from other places in the United States. And this is business people were taking on board. There's this one, Francesca Ocasio or something, I forget her name, this African Brit woman, And she was this amazing lady. She was the human resources manager for DEFRA, Department of Environment, Farming, or something or other. And she was saying when she first came into this government department, sort of they were getting outcomes. So if they, way she said it, if the team went to Brussels and they got the sort of the piece of paper back, you know, the what they wanted, then they would get promotions. But what she was saying, that modern business, it's not whether you get the outcomes, it's how you get those outcomes. The process is as important as the result, because if you get those outcomes and everybody's just really pissed off at the company, they're fed up because, you know, they've been working overtime and basically that they've got no real commitment to the process, those people leave. So the success is not sustainable. So what she was actually doing, so I'll just finish. What she actually did, she managed to finally convince the people who awarded the promotions and the pay rises to actually to not just look at their outcomes and what they achieved, but how they achieved that. Because you all know what government departments are like. Why are they like that? Now, why are the education department sort of in Perth and having all the problems with OBEs and goodness and what else? It's the process which these things were arrived at. That's the weakness. So this is actually where, you know, she was obviously this a leader of this human resources movement, and she'd actually changed the whole culture in this government department. So people who were leaders, team workers, who had this morale, people working together, these were the ones who got the promotion. So they were rewarded, the people with the real skills, rather than the people who got the job done at any cost. Now that was actually this was not just government departments, and I'd say like PricewaterhouseCoopers, Intel, don't know who else was there, but those were actually on the list of people who were coming to my masterclass, NHS. So these are actually, you know, big organizations. So multinationals are taking that on board as well. You're hearing the business of the future here in Buddhist Society of Western Australia. And you heard it here first. So do you want to come back again with that, Lawrence? Yeah. Yeah. Okay, I think, I get your question now. You're saying that if it is a big multinational company, they may have like good work procedures for their staff, but their goals, their ethics of where they're actually going can be quite harmful. I did see in the newspaper today that there was a group of from Greenpeace and McDonald's executives on a canoe going up the Amazon. Amazing picture, simply because even the multinationals are starting to get an ethical conscience, because they know they're not going to sustain their company unless they do.
Arahant Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhiwa Devi Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhamma Namasami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namami.